You're listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast, brought to you by Ministry Grid. Ministry Grid is an online church leadership and volunteer training platform offering a library of thousands of videos and a suite of powerful admin tools to provide practical training for every area of ministry in your church. Find out more and get a free 30-day trial at ministrygrid.com/howitworks.
Welcome to 5 Leadership Questions. My name is Todd Adkins, and I'm hosting solo today. Barnabas is once again out of town, so we're doing this, it seems, more and more where we're flying solo. But today, I have a special treat for you guys. I have Louis Giglio with us, and he is, of course, the pastor of Passion City in Atlanta. And also, he has a brand new book that just came out called Come Back, The Comeback. And it's just, guys, it's a great opportunity to take a look at what is really matters in your life and to take a chance to reset and look at getting a fresh start day by day. Can you tell us a little bit more about that book?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, by the way. And Barnabas, we miss you today, but I know you're having an amazing trip down in Cabo, so I hope that goes great, and we'll hope to see you when you get back.
I think he's actually in Wisconsin, which is what makes it even better.
Okay, well, that's good. I think people would have enjoyed thinking he was in Cabo better, but hey, you know. The Comeback is really a collection of stories of hope, and I share them both personally. You know, Todd, I opened the book with a story of one of my own comebacks from a really dark place in my life 7 years ago, and try to be transparent and vulnerable so that people don't, you know, think, and I know a lot of people wouldn't, but some people still have the misconception that if you're, you know, so-called spiritual leader, that you're immune to the, you know, to life, and that's absolutely not the case. And sometimes I think the more you're trying to steward, the more susceptible you are to crashes like I had in anxiety, depression, worry, fear, dread. And it was a months-long tunnel for me, and I wanted to tell that story. And so I share that story in the book. I some other people were kind enough to lend the stories of their pain to the book as well, people from our church here at Passion City and friends of ours. And the book really is just trying to meet us all. You know, everybody in my mind is either in a storm right now. I mean, there are people listening to us right now, and they're in some kind of storm right now. Or we're all happy that we just came out of a storm, you know. We just kind of came through the treatments 2 months ago or got some resolution in a relationship. But the other side of it is that we're all going into a storm at some point in the future. And the book is trying to encourage us all that whatever circumstance we're in, God is bigger than that circumstance. And we need that. And we need that message of hope. And so I hope it really encourages people. It's not a simple, you know, little formula for how you can put your life all back together again and wrap it in a nice bow. Some of the stories that are in the comeback aren't going to have nice bows on them. There isn't going to be a starting all over again for some of the people in this book, but there is going to be a start again. And when you can't start over, you can start again. And I hope that it really encourages a lot of people.
Well, I think honestly, that's it's a great place to start our first question, which is who are you learning from right now? I'm assuming in writing a book, like Come Back, it's going to be from some of those stories.
Yeah, well, you know, I try to learn from everybody around me, and I think that's probably one of the secrets to great leadership. I have the opportunity to have some friends of mine that are really extraordinary, world-class leaders, and I mean, like, literally business leaders, political leaders, and I watch them, and I notice that the best leaders learn from everything and everybody. And that teachable spirit, the curiosity, they say, is the key to genius. And so if you meet people who are, you know, pretty much dialed down into Netflix every night, yeah, and aren't really good question askers, they're probably not going to revolutionize too much in life from a leadership point of view. Great leaders ask questions. And the greatest leaders are the curious ones who just have this kind of insatiable desire to know how do things work? Why do things work? Why do things not work? And so I try, and I know that's, you know, a dumb answer, but I try to learn from everything and everybody. I'm observing all the time. But, you know, two people that I've learned a lot from this in the last 6 months and really been privileged to be around, one of them is Horst Schulze. And Horst was one of the architects that pioneered the Ritz-Carlton hotel brand, actually here in Atlanta, Georgia, and took that from a hotel to a chain of hotels around the world. He's no longer in that business, but he was one of the major architects of that. And I heard Horst speak at the Global Leadership Summit this summer, and I knew him. We'd met. He lives here in town. But when I heard him speak at the Global Leadership Summit, I was just blown away. And I knew that he didn't have enough time to get all of what he wanted to get in. And so I asked him if he would come and spend some time with our team, our label team, our conferences team, our church staff team, our publishing team. And he did. He said yes. And so he came and downloaded a couple of hours worth into our team. And I am still reeling from all of what he shared. And Horst's primary communication is around the idea of creating loyal customers. And I know, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure what kind of leadership everybody listening today is, but we all want loyal customers, whether it's in church or business or, you know, education, wherever we are. And he talked about how to move people from being satisfied customers. Obviously, we don't want dissatisfied customers. He called them terrorists to your organization. He said they cannot wait to talk bad about you and your organization. So obviously, we don't want dissatisfied customers, but to move a satisfied customer to a loyal customer. And he kind of branded luxury service and the attitude of it's my pleasure. And so I'm learning a lot from him right now, and our team's learning a lot from him right now about stretching our capacity to be excellent and even extraordinary in everything we do. He told a story, Todd, about growing up in Europe in a little bitty town, very poor family. But eventually he went to work at one of the great hotels in Europe, 5-star, all, you know, world hotel. And he worked in the dining room, the main dining room, fine dining. And he's just a little busboy on the side. But he said he watched the maitre d', and he learned that the maitre d' could speak 5 languages. He could go to one table and speak German, and one table and speak Italian. The next table he could speak French. And he said he watched how he treated people, and he noticed that everybody wanted the maitre d' to come to his table. And he said, and when he showed up at work, he looked perfect. His outfit was immaculate, and his attitude, he said, he always said to us, you don't go to work to do a job. You go to work to be excellent. And he said, as a 14-year-old boy, that just seared into my mind. And he said, I watched him move through the restaurant, and I watched how every table, political leaders, business leaders, entertainment leaders, they loved it when the maitre d' came to their table. It made them feel special and valuable. And I said to myself, he's one of us. And we were taught in life that the people who come to our restaurant are the important people. But I saw in the maitre d' that we are also important people. And he said, I just knew right then that if I set my mind to go to work every day, not to do a job, but if I went to work to be excellent every day, that I could instill in my teams of people, all of the people who work for me, that it's not just our guests who are the important people, but all of us are the important people. And it just, you know, for people who are doing what looks like a mundane task or a necessary job every day, that mindset and mentality is what moves us from being above average to extraordinary and from extraordinary to exceptional. And obviously, that's kind of what we all want to be a part of. Secondly, real fast, learn a lot from Bill Hybels. Bill has been kind enough to sort of mentor me a little bit as a pastor. I've only been a pastor of a local church for 6 years, so I don't know what I'm doing. And Bill has been kind enough, one of the few people, honestly, I've asked a bunch of people, but he's been one of the few people to really lean in, make himself available. And here's a guy that just celebrated 40 years at Willow Creek Community Church just a few Sunday nights ago at the United Center in Chicago. And honestly, I don't think we're talking too big here, but we throw the word legend around a lot. But this guy's a legend. They revolutionized the way people experienced God in the local church in the 70s that transferred into the 80s, 90s, and on into today. And churches like North Point, Saddleback, all these great churches, all way downstream of what Bill was doing. And those two guys are both teaching me a lot about leadership right now.
Excellent. I love what you said about specifically two things. First of all, you need to know that recent guests have included Maxwell and Groeschel and Max Licato. All three also said something about curiosity and how important curiosity was. Now, we normally, one of the great things about the whole five questions framework, I think we're in like our 50th episode now, and we ask the same five questions. So people know what to expect. But it's great in that everything, you know, everybody's story is a little bit different. Everybody's experience is a little bit different. And all these great leaders are answering this question in unique enough ways. But what is absolutely striking to me has been the recent run of curiosity and how important asking good questions is to leadership, how important listening is to leadership. So the other takeaway that I just want to draw out is you basically saying, you know, leaders don't do exceptional things. They do ordinary things exceptionally well. So I greatly appreciate that. When we look at I think that's a good time to move into our second questions. Really, what obstacles are you currently facing in leadership, in either in your organization or personally? I know that, you know, you're 6 months into a church, which that's
6 years. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Not that new, but it feels like it sometimes.
I meant 6 years. Sorry. Because the 7 year mark is usually when, you know, things start to, the honeymoon period is over. And, most, you know, in most instances, if you look at the research, 7 years is about the time that people start to look elsewhere,
or
they get
goodness.
Distracted.
Yeah, man, I'm so glad I did this interview. This is amazing. This really giving me something to look forward to.
It's an intervention. What obstacles are you currently facing now?
You know, and you know, for me, a lot of people have told me, I'm probably sure there's research to support. You know, the good thing about research is that research can support everything that you want it to support.
Oh, that's true.
And I don't really know how to slice it up, but a lot of guys told me that in church planning, the 5 year mark is the money. And it's where a lot of churches fold. In fact, a lot of startups fold, a lot of enterprise that's off getting off the ground folds up at the 5 year mark. Maybe it's a 7 year mark. For us, it was the 5 year mark. And I call it, you know, a process. Being a pastor and being a leader is a process of managing expectations. Everyone in your organization has an expectation of how the company is going to be run, what the direction is going to be, what the pace is going to be, what the outcomes need to be, everyone. And if they don't, then, you know, you really don't want them in your organization. You just don't want static people around. You want people that are thinking, what should we be doing? What are we doing? Are we doing the right thing? And when you're a pastor, it's compounded by the fact that, you know, you're talking about the most important things of life. And so everyone has a spiritual expectation. The church is A, B, or C. We should be doing X, Y, or Z, and we should be doing it at this pace. And I don't discount any of that. But as a pastor, when you've got that coming at you from every direction, and one person's telling you we're moving too fast, and then the next meeting you go to, they're telling you we're moving too slow. And then the next meeting you go to, somebody says, hey, the weight's too heavy here. And the next person says, man, I need more to do. And so a leader is constantly managing expectations. And the problem at the 5 year point, I think those expectations catalyze and people say, we've given you time. We've given you some couple of years now. We've given you the benefit of the doubt. We've been patient, but now we're kind of see that writing on the wall. And, you know, this thing isn't ever going to be the way we thought it was going to be. And hopefully what you want to be at that point is you want to be able to say, but it is going to be what we've always said it was going to be. And so a good leader doesn't change his direction and his tack every 6 months. And he certainly doesn't change direction and tack every time he has a conversation with somebody who has a different expectation. What you want to be able to say 5 years in is maybe we haven't done what you wanted to do, and maybe we haven't done it as fast as you wanted to do, but we have done what we've said we were going to do. We might not have done all of it yet, but we're moving in the same direction. And so 5 years is a scramble for me. And it's a lot of coming and a lot of going and a lot of giving up and a lot of leaning in. And at the same time, some people say, my expectation's not met. I think I'm going to move on. Somebody else is saying, man, I feel galvanized by the fact that people are moving on. That means that it's not the easy glory days of year one and two where it was just a honeymoon ride.
Yeah.
But now we're really down to who are we? And I say, I'm with us. And so it's a good and a bad season, but it's a big transition. And we went through that. And I think coming out of that was a season of aligning. And I think that's how it probably the rhythm works for every leader. And if you can anticipate it, you'll even do better. But to see the lows of, you know, mismanaged expectation or mismet expectation, and then to ride up the ridge again of alignment, which is just vision casting. It's reclaiming who we are and what we're going to be and the direction we're going to go in and what leadership we're going to follow. And so we've come through that, which has been amazing. And then usually on the backside of that is an abundant season. So it looks like attrition, but it really galvanizes vision. And out of galvanized vision, you usually see an exponential expansion. And I think we're trying to hold on to that ride right now. And, you know, as a rookie pastor, I didn't really know that's how it worked, but I do now. So if we roll back around in 5 more years or 7 more years, and we have another one of those seasons of, you know, the adjustment time, I won't freak out as much as I did the first time because you learn by experience. And unfortunately, I was 50 when we planted the church. So, you know, I'm learning a lot of things for the first time. But at the same time, I think for me, if you want to boil it down, what's my greatest thing I'm learning right now or obstacle? And I'm good at sharing this with other leaders. In fact, I shared it with a CEO friend of mine the other day. And I was like, man, if I could take that advice, I'd be home free. But I think it's to remember in balance that God has put you, if you're listening to this right now and you're a leader, it's most likely, not 100%, but it's most likely that God put you in that place. The scripture says God raises up rulers and he puts them down. And so it wasn't just a series of events or circumstances or some goodwill or good fortune or you knew somebody, but God has put you in that position. And in humility, which we all have because we walk with Jesus every day, and the byproduct of that is we are humble, but in humility, you know God has put me in this place of leadership. And so what he wants me to do is lead. So I'm going to gather information. I'm going to listen to the people around me. I'm going to build a team, but I'm going to lead. And I'm going to take ownership of the fact that God has put me here to move forward, not to move sideways, not to move backwards, not to shrink back, but he's put me here to move forward. And to be comfortable with the fact that when you move forward, most people are going to move with you. And if people don't, that's great. God put you there to lead. So lead and move on. And I think some people that maybe comes a little more natural. For other people, it's a little bit more of a struggle. But for me, that's what I'm trying to walk in right now on the church side. And leading organizationally, passion conferences, other things. Those weren't as much of a challenge for me, but leading in the pastoral role, it's humbly remembering that God put me here to lead in this moment. And so I'm therefore going to lead, and I'm not going to worry too much about, you know, trying to make sure that I'm leading into every single person's expectation.
Gotcha. So Napoleon had a rule of thirds when it came to change. He said, a third of his army was always ready for change. A third of his army was always reluctant to change or dug in their feet. And the third of the army was just waiting to see who wins. So when you look at maybe the people that aren't ready for change or weren't ready for change in this new season, how did you handle that?
Well, I think on the macro side, we're trying to wire change into our culture. And so if change appears on the horizon as, oh my gosh, we're going to change something, then I don't think the culture was good to start with. I think we need to incubate a culture of change. The dynamic nature of the church and the gospel is that we are a moving, living organism, and therefore there's going to be change. And if the church, if the gospel is real, then people are going to come from death to life. If people come from death to life, there are going to be more people in our mix right now than there were 6 months ago. And if there are more people in our mix right now than there were 6 months ago, a whole lot of things have to change. And so if the gospel is the engine of your church, and I'm just speaking because we have a church, somebody can translate this into their culture. But if the gospel is the engine of the church, then change is the necessary rhythm of the church. And you're always going to be outgrowing your space. You're always going to be outstripping your resources. You're always going to be needing to add to your leadership component. You're always going to be having problems to solve and people to tend to. And I think if you can weave that into the culture, then you can sort of erase a few of the thirds, because the "we don't like change" people don't want that culture. And so they're going to move on from your organization in the first place. But how do you deal with it is you recast vision for people, and change has to have a reason. And the answer, well, because we're doing it, isn't a good reason. Because I said that's what we're doing isn't a good reason. Because I'm the leader and I decided we're going to change isn't a good reason. So you have to communicate the vision to people. Give them an opportunity to question the vision, to ask about the vision. But at the end of the day, more than likely, if you're leading with a few people around you, you're not going to change that vision. And so you communicate the vision. You try to win them to that vision again. You try to help them see their role in that vision. And then you move on in the vision. And what happens is they move on with you or they don't. You hope they don't stay and just continue to be disgruntled with the vision. You hope they either join on with you or move off from that idea.
So I always talk about if you have a clear conviction and you have a clear culture, which it sounds like you do, the last piece of alignment is the construct, is the systems and the processes that you put in place to, you know, actually make it all happen. How have you all, so being 6 years in, how have you shifted there, or have you shifted there?
I'm not 100% sure I know how to answer the question, but I did really, really love your model. And it sounds like something that I need you to come and do here.
No problem.
You know, it, that sense of the systems is, I think, where everything, you know, the growth potential is for everything. And for us, we have a clear vision and we have a very clear culture. And I think it's beginning to articulate that. You know, the scripture says in one place, write the vision down. And so I find that you gain ground when you write things down. And so we created an us document this year, and it's the story of us, simply put. The bottom line being that, you know, we are greater than me. And so we created this us document. Most churches have one, and it's 13 culture values of Passion City Church. One of them says, we design everything. And it just unfolds in a simple paragraph why we don't take any little part of Passion City Church for granted, but every little detail matters to us because it's a part of us telling an extraordinary story. And it just gave us some footing with our, you know, 1,800, 2,000 door holders is what we call volunteers here, that all of our door holders could lean in now to this document. And so that's a system. It's just a little system.
Yeah.
But it's a way of putting the vision in writing. And then now every team, as they gather and they rallying around both the objectives that they have to do on a Sunday or Thursday or whatever day it is, but now they're also rallying around the culture in which they do what they do. It gives them a jumping off point and a touch point to come back to. You know, Horst said that Ritz-Carlton has, I don't want to get this wrong, I want to say 28 values or 31 values or something in their company. And they have a little booklet or a little pamphlet thing that's folded over, and there's a value for every day. And he pulled his out of his jacket pocket, and he said, today's the whatever it was, the 17th of the month. And so our 17th value is, and then he reads it, and he said, every employee at every Ritz-Carlton every day has a value that they're wrapping their head around. And so I wanted to take that a step further. We haven't gotten there yet with our 13 culture statements and put them into some processable statements that every door holder in our house can carry with them every single day and look at this again and go, this is who we are. This is the spirit in which we're doing what we're doing. This is the culture that we're creating around us. And, you know, it's incredibly important that we think about that, because culture isn't a yes or no. It's not either we're going to have it or we're not going to have it. Everyone has a culture. And if you don't create it, it will be created for you.
Yes.
And so it's really important to do that. And so that's one way, just in that us document, that now we can bring a new door holder on. And instead of just hoping that they osmose a lot of our culture, which most people do not do, we can say, here's our document. Take it, digest it, read it. We'll come back and talk about it, and we'll keep talking about it all year long.
Very good. Well, that leads us to our next question, and I'm very scared that we're going to run out of time because we have two more after this one. What is the main point of your emphasis for your leadership team right now? And it may be some of the stuff that we've just been talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the main things we're trying to do right now is communicate to our team that every role on our team is a critical role in the goal that we're trying to accomplish. We talk about in the language of the story of the four friends who brought their paralyzed friend to Jesus, and they can't get in. And the scripture, the way Luke says it is that there wasn't a way. And I love that because that's part of our culture too. You know, when there isn't a way, find a way. And that's what they did. So they bust the roof open. They lower the friend. The friend gets forgiven and healed. It's a double whammy. It's more than they even expected. They just thought he was going to walk again. They didn't know he was going to get his sins forgiven. So the night ends. The thing is amazing. Everybody heads out. We got healed people. We got Jesus. Everybody leaves the house. Well, the homeowner's got a roof that's busted open. So what's not in scripture in the gospel accounts is who comes along and repairs the roof. But there had to be a roof repair. And so we talk about it this way. Whenever people are coming to be touched powerfully by Jesus, normally there's a roof repair job that's going to have to happen when it's over. And so in every organization, the visible things are usually applauded and the invisible things are not. And part of that is a leadership thing of helping to lift up invisible things and give them value. But a lot of it is a personal ownership of my space, my desk, my chair, my responsibility, and understanding and reminding myself and keeping myself in the stream of the idea that whatever it is I'm doing is a significant part of the enterprise, in our case, of people meeting Jesus and having their lives changed. And I think that's one of the main things that we're trying to instill and breathe into our culture right now, because that, again, helps take above average teams to exceptional teams and exceptional teams to extraordinary teams. And an extraordinary team, I think, happens when every individual on that team believes that their role, seen or unseen, is a critical component to the success of that organization. And when we feel that way, it shuts the door on the enemy's number one way of defeating and deflating us, which is no one sees you, no one cares about you, what you're doing doesn't matter, and no one ever recognizes what you're about. And that would cause anybody to not want to come to work on a given day.
Let's close in prayer. Well, as a leadership development guy, I mean, you know, that's words I long to hear from any pastor. That's Ephesians 4 in action. And so, definitely greatly appreciate that. I do want to move into shifting completely into a different area, and ask you, what does leadership look like in your home?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, for me, I mean, I'm married to an amazing woman. We have the privilege of working together for most of our lives. She runs our record label, Six Steps Records, manages our artists, Chris Tomlin, Matt Redman, Crowder, Passion, Christian Stanfield, Christy Knuckles. So she's got her hands full. I mean, she's doing amazing things. She leads The Grove, which is our ladies initiative here in the city. Through Passion City and a host of other things, advises on a lot of things we do. So we have a partnership. But I think leading in the home is a few things. And I'm not saying I get all these right, because obviously when we start talking about our relationship with our wives, and we don't have kids. We do have London. She's a year and a half old golden doodle. But you know, so this is what I got to lead, you know, when I go home. I got to lead Shelley. And I got to lead me, and I've got to lead London. And I think most leaders forget to include themselves in the leadership equation of their home. And you say to a leader, what's it like to lead at home? They say, well, my husband and my children, or whatever, my wife and my children. But I got to lead me first, and I have to lead Shelley, and I have to lead London. And I don't know if we're including pets in this or not, but I guess anybody that has one knows that the pets got to get on board with the program, or else, you know, things are going to break down. And so for me, leading Shelley is a couple of things. It's one, having a direction for my life. And I'm just putting it husband to wife. And I know a lot of the, you know, people listening to this that are leaders and CEOs and whatever are women, but I'm a guy. So for me, I need to have a direction. I need to go home with a direction, with a vision, with a calling, because what women want, I think deep down, is a guy that has a clue about where he's going and where their family's going and why they're going there. So that's number one for me. Have a direction, have a vision, have something to invite Shelly into, because she wants to be invited into things, I've learned. She wants, she doesn't want to make all the decisions for our family. And a lot of guys shove that off on their wife and say, hey, I'm running this great enterprise. You figure out how to run the house. And wives want to figure out how to run the house. They want a guy to set the pace for where their family goes. So that's number one. I got to have a direction. Number two, I've got to recognize that Shelly is an equal partner in what God has called us to do. And I may be the leader structurally, but we are equal partners. We are two made one in our household. And so that means that I don't call her the wife. I know some guys do, and maybe their wives love it. My wife would not like that. I don't say the wife such and such or the wife what the other. I say Shelly because she has a name and she's an equal partner in our home. And she's an equal partner in our ministry. And I'm not going to be any kind of pastor without her support, encouragement, input. And so when I see her as an equal partner, I'm open to her input into my life. And she gives me input into my life. She's one of the few people that tells me when my talk stinks. She's one of the few people that tells me things that I need to shift and change that other people around me, you know, are a little bit nervous about saying. And she gives me great advice. Incredibly wise advice. And I take it. And a lot of times I just take credit for it. No, just kidding. I try to always say, you know, Shelly thinks this or that, but she's just incredibly smart. And so it's all those things. It's me having a direction for our family. And I always have. Shelly's never come home and said, Louie, I think this is what God wants us to do. We're moving to Cleveland and we're doing something else. I always have stepped into our equation and said, honey, this is what I believe God wants us to do. But I see it as an equal partnership, so I wait for her buy-in. When we planted this church, I knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. No way, we're not doing this. Shelly did not feel it right away, and so I had to wait until God moved her heart as firmly as he moved my heart, and I was not going to move forward till he did that. Thirdly, as an equal partner, I listened to her. And I try to speak into her the same thing that I try to speak into everybody else. And I think those, there's a lot more to the equation than that, but I think those are the top line things that if leaders will just embrace those three main ideas, and it changes the way the dynamic feels in the home and the partner, the spouse, the kids don't feel pressed down or pushed off to the side. They feel invited in and they feel like they matter in the equation, and they feel like it's a we. And if we can create a we and not a me, then we're always going to have a win.
That's a very good word. So the last question is this. If you could go back and talk to your 20-year-old self about preparing to lead, which you get to do all the time. Asking you this question is different than asking anyone else this question, simply because, you know, obviously passion has affected hundreds of thousands of young adults who are now adults, and you continue to impact hundreds of thousands of young adults every year. And you have an opportunity to help shape 20-year-olds, but what would you do if you could go back and tell yourself, 20-year-old Louie, about preparing to lead?
Man, that's such a great question. And I don't know, man, I just don't know which way I would try to come around it.
He was a difficult guy.
You know, well, my main philosophy in life is that, you know, it all works out. And so somehow, you know, God just gets in there, even with 20-year-olds. And I try to really have patience with them because I was kind of clueless when I was 20, and I was a late bloomer. I flunked out of college twice. Everything just took me a while to finally like get it in drive, you know, and then kind of get on a path. But I think the main thing I would say to a 20-year-old is don't stress over God's will. I think that's the number one thing I try to transfer. And I think that's the work of the devil. that high school kids and middle school kids and college students are stressing over. I got to find God's will for my life. I got to figure out God's will for my life. Whatever we're thinking when we're 20 about what our life's going to look like, hands down, anybody 50 will tell you it is not going to look like that. You are not going to end up where you think you're going to end up. And I know it does happen for a few people. I was reading this book the other day, about Lessons of Leadership from an Astronaut, incredible book. And this guy, when he was 7 years old, looked up in the sky, saw like, you know, something flying over, space shuttle or something, and said, this is what I'm going to do. And he grew up and was the first astronaut from Canada and went to the International Space Station and blah, blah, blah. You know, he knew from seven and that's what he did. That doesn't usually happen for people. Normally, people start down one road, you know, Grant, my navigator, went to college, finance major, ended up being a professional tennis player, ended up being a tennis coach. Now he's going to be a pastor and a leader. You know, he didn't see that coming when he was 11th grade, 12th grade, starting college. So I think it's don't worry about 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now. Try to put yourself in environments, gravitate towards whatever it takes to shape you into the best possible person God can make you right now. So that means gravitate toward difficulty, gravitate toward hardship, lean into pain and disappointment. Embrace the ups and downs of life, because these are the things that are making you the best possible person that you can be, so that when the surprise comes over the horizon, that's where you'll be. And it would translate, take for me, I'm a pastor, I'm a speaker, I'm a communicator. What I would say to a 20-year-old me is, don't try to get the mic, try to have something to say. And it's that parallels into all the other fields that people are leaning towards. And it's, don't try to get on a stage. Try to be worthy of the stage. Don't try to run a business. Try to learn how to serve people. And I think it's becoming the very best person you can become with the best message that you can share to the world, with the best heart of service for people. And then sit back and wait, because God's going to surprise you and the chapters are going to unfold and they're not going to be the way you think. The pain is not going to be what you thought you were going to have to go through. And the highs and the joy is not going to be, it's going to exceed what you ever thought you were going to experience. And there's no way to prepare for that. The only way to prepare for that really is to just day by day put yourself in that position where God can shape you. And it typically means patience. And, you know, this new generation, they're saying, you know, they don't want to wait. They want to do things now. They want access to the leader today. They want input on every decision. But patience is still in the equation, and every great thing that's ever happened has required patience.
My first semester, I had a 1.2, and by my first year, I had a 1.5. I pull it up there, but you know, probation, the whole thing, and it's extremely interesting how many leaders that you meet that's they have a similar story. It was just finding their spot, and ultimately it was understanding God and his grace.
You know, Todd, I think all of us, you know, need that little glimpse today that somehow, some way, God's using it all to help advance his purposes, advance his agenda on earth, and he's going to see us through to the other side.
So good. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. Thank you so much for sharing so much of your story and so much of who you are, both as a pastor and leader as well.
I hope it encourages somebody. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real treat for me.
All right. Well, we would love to have you back on a later date and time. And I'm probably going to end up contacting your wife as well, because it sounds like she's a pretty solid leader in her own right.
This would be a very good move on your part. You will not ever call me again once you have Shelly on the Leadership Podcast. It's been good being on.
Excellent. Well, you have a great day, man.
Take care, man. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the 5 Leadership Questions Podcast. To learn more about how you can train leaders in your church, visit ministrygrid.com/howitworks and watch a short demo video. For participating, you will get a free 30-day trial for your entire church. Again, that's ministrygrid.com/howitworks.